Welcome to the Co-ops and Campuses podcast series, which is being recorded on the unceded and ancestral territory of the Musqueam people. It doesn't take much to realize things aren't going too well for the planet these days. What is clear is that climate change and growing inequity is not going to be fixed by more disaster capitalism. In this series, we're going to learn from students, staff, faculty, and activists who are actively responding to the crisis we face through building cooperatives on campuses, and in some cases, in building an actual cooperative university. I'm Michelle Stack, and I'll be your host. Today, I'm interviewing Elvi Delbianco. Elvi works internally on disseminating knowledge of the cooperative business model to increase VanCity's capacity to support co-ops and externally on building partnerships and developing projects. This work is largely informed by the activities of Italy's Emilia-Romagna region, the world's most significant cooperative economy, and the focus of VanCity's cooperative study tour, which Elvi has organized since 2008. Elvi is the founder and organizer of Cooperate Now, a co-op business model education program, and he's also a member of the COVID-19 response, building higher learning resilience in the face of epidemics through cooperatives. Thanks so much for joining us today, Elvi.
Very happy to be here with you, Michelle, today.
Great. Well, Elvi, the question I'm asking everybody to start with is, what got you involved in co-ops?
I'm one of the more fortunate in this respect because I learned about co-ops by being offered a trip to Italy and to go to Emilia-Romagna back in 2004.
That's a pretty good deal.
It was great. My understanding of co-ops up until that time was like zero. I knew nothing about co-ops other than what I had studied at university doing a political science undergrad, cooperatives in Stalinist Soviet Union, you know, forced collectivization of the peasantry. I remember reading about cooperatives in a science fiction novel about the settlement of Mars. I thought, wow, this is really kind of out there. And then Bob Williams, who was a former government minister in the Dave Barrett government in 1972 to 75, at that point, a former chair of the board of VanCity, was doing some work as the VanCity senior research fellow and was part of this study tour to Northern Italy. I had contacted him looking for some work, and he says, well, I got to do this tour. You want to come with us? That was a real eye-opener, starting from the moment when I told my parents about this. My parents are from Northern Italy, not further north than Emilia-Romagna. And I told them, well, I've got this job. And my dad said, well, what for? Well, we're going to go. We're going to look at co-ops. He goes, what's the big deal? We were a member of a wine-growing co-op. We were a member of a grain production co-op. And I had no idea. This history was hidden to me. I'm a third-generation cooperator, apparently. My parents grew up post-World War II Italy. Lots of hardship. The economy, the countryside was devastated. And the co-ops put money in their pockets that otherwise they would not have had. And that was critical to their existence. And I think that was my real introduction to co-ops. Co-ops fly underneath the radar. We don't really know a lot about co-ops. But I went on this study tour and discovered Emilia-Romagna. We have a longstanding relationship with the University of Bologna and have been spending time there every year learning about their cooperative economy, which is, it's a jurisdiction that is roughly the same population base as British Columbia. It's much smaller, of course. But BC has something like some 700-odd co-ops there. At last count, there's some 5,100 co-ops in Emilia-Romagna that account for about 15% of the entire employment and about 20 to 25% of the GDP and play a central role in their economy. And so that was my introduction. And it's taken me some 16 of these trips to sort of really get a handle on the very complex relationships that they have and the very dense kind of supports that they have in place in order to be able to make this thing fly. So that was my intro.
So can you tell us a bit about those complex relationships and supports? What is it that makes it work?
Yeah, Italians, at the risk of generalizing too much, I mean, they don't like bureaucracy too much because they suffer some terrible bureaucracy. The joke is in Italy, I asked my friends this, is it true that the average Italian loses 2 weeks a year to dealing with Italian bureaucracy? And they said, no, it's much worse than that. But on the ground, in the co-op world, if you look at their relationship maps, these figures that they'll put out to showing you who's doing what, they're incredibly complex. But everybody knows their part in it. It's everything from financing mechanisms, all co-ops in Italy are required to allocate 3% of their net profits into a fund that goes to supporting co-op development.
Wow.
We regularly visit one of these funds. Their capitalization is in the hundreds of millions of euros. There are loan guarantee funds for co-ops. The BC Cooperative Association is a relatively small group in British Columbia. The Cooperative Association in Emilia-Romagna, there are three main ones. Two of them have their skyscrapers. So they have all the kind of supports in place. If you want to start a co-op, you get a case manager attached to you. You get access to all kinds of supports that you need in order to be able to get your business up and running in a quick and efficient fashion. And there are the official supports, and then there are these very kind of complex relationships that co-ops have. Co-ops in particular sectors will often help each other out because they're all part of a network and part of value chains. And so they recognize that other co-ops succeeding is part of their own success and will go the extra mile in order to be able to support each other.
So it sounds like there's a lot of different kinds of co-ops. Maybe I could just get you to define what is a co-op.
Yeah, well, the International Cooperative Alliance has a definition that I'm ashamed to say I have not memorized because it's the kind of thing that's sort of defined by committee. The definition that I like to use is a little bit more simple. It's a democratically owned and governed enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily democratically managed, although some co-ops do that, but a democratically owned and governed enterprise for sure. That is common to all cooperatives.
And so is Van City a cooperative?
Yes, we are. We're a cooperative of some 530,000 members. We're the largest single standing credit union or cooperative financial institution in the country. Desjardins in Quebec is a different kind of system. And we have assets that we manage that exceed, I think we're at $23 billion.
Wow. And so what makes Van City different than a bank?
Banks have external shareholders. I think this is true of all corporations. You have the shareholders. You can imagine sort of sitting on top of the structure. You have the business, the machine, the staff, and all the processes and systems that are in place to generate money. And you've got a bunch of customers that sort of, you know, feed into this and get some services back. So there is this kind of separation. If you're a shareholder of a bank, you don't necessarily have to have an account at that bank. You don't necessarily have to be a citizen of Canada to be banking at that organization. You could be a shareholder on Lake Lucerne, you know, generating all kinds of dividends for yourself and putting that away. In a credit union or financial services cooperative, those kind of relationships are all together. The members are the owners. There are no external shareholders. The organization exists to serve those members' needs. And in the case of a credit union, it's access to affordable financial services. In a bank, shareholders are, you know, board of directors are picked by generally the people who have the most money invested in that company. At a credit union, it's based on a democratic basis. The board of directors is selected from the membership. And this is a subtle but really important distinction. Political power in a cooperative or in a credit union is based on one person, one vote, irrespective of how much money we have invested in that organization. So you, Michelle, have $1 million in Van City, as I know you do.
I wish.
Yeah. And I have a few thousand dollars, but we both have the same voice. We don't necessarily benefit in the same way. We don't necessarily use the services in the same way, but our influence is not proportional to the amount of money that we have invested. This is the critical distinction between the two.
Great. And so you're talking about co-ops being under the radar quite often. Why do you think that is, that there's so little knowledge of co-ops?
Yeah, I think there's a variety of reasons for that. One, co-ops are not necessarily sexy kind of creatures, if I can put it that way. They're practical mechanisms for providing people with the fundamental needs that they have for food, housing, transportation. And in order to do that, sometimes co-ops aren't necessarily generating a whole lot of capital or a whole lot of profit to do that. Some co-ops don't make any money at all, but I mean, they break even or they cover their costs, but that's okay because they're providing a benefit. That's the real important part of that exercise. That doesn't really fit very well with our popular culture that's really based on this kind of supposedly unfettered kind of competition and, you know, winner take all and zero sum game and somebody's making huge piles of money. That's an exciting, dramatic kind of thing that doesn't really fit with a much more humble kind of approach and a much more practical and no nonsense kind of approach that's represented by a co-op. So I know some co-ops that have no real physical presence, no market kind of presence. They have no website. I know of a particular co-op has no website, no sign above its facility, because it appeals to the membership and the membership is using that service and is benefiting from that service. And they don't need to be out there in community. I think they could probably do something in order to announce their presence, you know, and let us know that they're existing and doing that. But this is often the case. And the other problem is our business schools, and this is a real problem, our business schools don't teach it. For the most part, it's almost completely absent from the space. Not to pick out UBC, but it's the Sauder School of Business at UBC, right? Yeah, I've had a number of colleagues go and get their master's there. They've used organizations like Vancity as case studies, but they never talk about the ownership structure.
Wow.
Right? And this despite the fact that there's a billion people on this planet that belong to at least one co-op. 250 million people plus are employed by co-ops. It's a business model with a history that official history that goes back some 200 years. And yet it's not worthy of being considered as a viable business model in business schools.
Now, one of the comments I had, I was talking about this with somebody and they said, well, but look at MEC, they failed.
Yeah.
Co-ops fail. So what's your response to that kind of answer? Well,
I've got news for people. Businesses fail all the time. You may not have noticed. Yes, MEC failed and that failure hurt me. I was a member of MEC and had been for many years. And I'm afraid I could see that disaster coming. And I think many of us did. Businesses fail. People take the failure of a cooperative really to heart because it's more than just a failure of a business. It's a failure of a community of interest. And people put their sweat equity and their aspirations into these organizations. And when they go down, it can be painful. Now, we could get into a long discussion as to why MEC failed, but I think it was definitely a failure of governance. And it was a real failure of a fundamental understanding of that business model. They didn't fail because they doubled down on being a co-op. They failed because they tried to make it into a corporation, because they pursued a path of growth, you know, growth that they couldn't sustain. And when they couldn't, they ran into trouble. And then instead of going to the membership and saying, we're in trouble, we need you to, to spend more money at our organization in order to keep things moving, they bypassed the membership altogether and decided to sell to one of these hedge funds. I don't think it was a failure of it as a business. I mean, there were some business problems that were certainly made, but it was a failure to adhere to the model.
To the cooperative model.
To the cooperative model. And, you know, there's been a number of studies. They pop up from time to time. I've seen some recent ones in Australia and the States, and there've been a few here in Canada. They paint an interesting story that, you know, all business, I work with a lot of startup co-ops, and startup co-ops will fail. Just like any business will fail. There's lots of churn when you're creating new businesses. Co-ops are twice as likely to survive as any other form of enterprise.
Yeah, that's so interesting that they're more likely to survive. Yet, as you were saying, business students don't learn about them.
No. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a question. I mean, I think this is a really important question, not just in business schools, but in education in general, is why are co-ops such a small part of the post-secondary sector? Not just in terms of housing, library services, food services.
Well, I think there are some practical challenges around this. Corporation, or as we would call it in BC, a company. A company is a company is a company is a company. They're all pretty much look the same. You gather up some shareholders, you put a thing, you create whatever, you go, you get successful, you sell it, somebody else takes it over, whatever. Co-ops are not so easy to get off the ground, eh? The process is different. You don't start with, I've gotten this idea for this pointless widget that nobody ever thought they needed before I told them that their life is dependent upon it. And then you create a company in order to deliver that to the market, right? You aggregate a market, you sell it. A co-op starts, again, in an unsexy fashion with a community, demographic, geographic, whatever, both. And that community needs something. It needs something kind of fundamental, like food or transportation, housing, or some kind of piece of common infrastructure or an employment opportunity. And then they roll up their sleeves and they create the mechanism by which they achieve that. Well, these kinds of communities often have gaps in terms of the skills that they have, right? We're trying to work on trying to achieve some kind of commonality, possibly consensus if we're lucky. This is not an easy kind of thing. I mean, this is a lot of meeting. There's a lot of head scratching. This is a lot of sweat equity that goes into this thing. And so it's impossible to be directive about a co-op. You know, from my perch at VanCity, I can't say, I'm going to support the creation of 20 co-ops this year. I can't decide that. Those communities can come to me and hopefully I can help them. But it's up to those communities to galvanize themselves in order to do that. The work that I'm trying to support is to make that process easier. So I think we'll always see fewer co-ops than we'll see of other forms of business. But they're so absolutely necessary because the social and economic impacts that come out of co-ops are disproportionate to what they look like from the outside, these modest kind of enterprises.
Yeah, it's such an ideal place, a messy place, but to learn about democratic governance and to learn the skills around that. So you mentioned business schools. How about in the K-12 curriculum? Have you done any work on that in terms of what children learn and youth learn about co-ops?
I have not. The British Columbia Cooperative Association did have a co-ops in schools program and had, I think, some success with that. I think we just simply don't have enough resources to be able to do that in a consistent kind of way. I think there's an excellent opportunity to be teaching some basic information about co-ops as part of almost like a civics kind of program, K-12 and at university. I think there'd be huge opportunities there. I think we all kind of struggle with not having enough resources and bandwidth to be able to do that.
Right. It's a perennial problem.
Yeah.
We talked a bit about MEC, a co-op that didn't do so well. What do you think, you've worked with a lot of co-ops, what are characteristics of co-ops that do well?
Well, like any kind of business, they have to have a solid business idea. There has to be a market for the service that's being developed. But definitely, there's some hard skills that are needed in order to get a co-op up and running. Generally, when you pull in a large enough group of people, you generally have those kinds of things, like project management skills or accounting skills or financial planning or legal or any of these kinds of things. These are really excellent things to bring to the table. And I think a willingness to put in a lot of time and energy and talking and passion. Cooperators are really passionate people. And whether I visited a co-op here or in Italy or elsewhere, they all got the funny twinkle in the eye. Eh? I mean, you know, their business is forged in a kind of a fire, right? In a crucible. And so they've brought a lot to themselves in order to be able to make that happen. And I don't think anybody would say that they've had an easy time of it, but they are without a doubt very, very happy to have created this mechanism that they are very much a part of.
Yeah, for sure. So a sense of belonging.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
A sense of common purpose. How badly do you need that thing? How badly do you need that job? I think a clear need is critical to this kind of thing.
One of the things I find interesting is when I talk about growing up in a co-op, people are so shocked by the trust, right? It's like, how could you trust people? Because we would share appliances or share like stuff for gardening. So this notion of how could you trust people, does that come up?
You know, I didn't lead with that, but I think that's critical. I think co-ops inevitably will fail in the absence of trust, but I don't think they don't necessarily kind of start that way. Co-ops are platforms for which people learn to trust each other. It's an opportunity for people to practice reciprocity. So you're going to help me out today and I'll help another member of the co-op in some way to my best abilities when I can. I think a co-op that structures itself in a way that that kind of communication can happen and these kinds of opportunities for people to sort of build these kinds of bonds, that expression of trust, I think, becomes social capital. And that becomes a very valuable kind of resource to that community and to the people outside of that community.
And yeah, talk a bit about how it becomes a resource for the people outside of the community.
Yeah. There was a co-op that I had visited a few times in Emilia-Romagna called Ceramica di Imola. It's a cooperative that produces ceramic tiles and some really beautiful stuff. I have a slight knowledge about this. My dad was a tile setter, so I got exposed to tiles, and I saw this place. It's like, wow, this stuff is quite clearly beautiful. This co-op was founded in the 1860s, so it's about 150 years old now. It was a cooperative of about 1,400 people work there, and 400 of those were members. So what they call in Italy a mutually non-privilegistic co-op, so a minority of the people who work there are the members. And they have reasons for that. In 2008, the financial crisis hits. At the same time that the competition from cheaper markets was ramping up for this cooperative, like perfect storm for them. They were 400 FTEs over budget. Imola is not a big community. I think it's maybe like 40,000 people, something like that, 50,000. And they were a major employer there, along with some other co-ops, actually. That's a lot to be over budget. Now, what would a corporation do in that particular case? They would cut. The cooperative decided not to do this. They said their decision was reduce wages and reduced hours for everybody, member, non-member alike. Nobody was going to get let go. My last trip to Italy before the pandemic in 2019, we had a chance to go back and visit them after. So we saw them immediately before the crisis, and now we're going to go back and see how they did. Met with the same wonderful guy that had talked to us a number of years earlier. Some people decided to leave because they didn't like the lower wages. Some people decided to take early retirement. So there was an attrition, but they didn't let anybody go. And they invested during that time into their physical plant and into finding new markets for their product. They came out from that really fundamental crisis and without having let go of anybody. Now, imagine in a small town like that, if you had cut 400 jobs, imagine the economic impact that that would have had on that community. Imagine the social problems that you would have caused by parents not having work, right? And all the social trouble that that would have caused. This was not a localized phenomenon to this one co-op. The cooperative sector in Italy during the time of that really grinding crisis not only did not let people go as a whole, some sectors did better than others. Some sectors got hit really hard. Employment in the cooperative sector in Emilia-Romagna went up during the crisis, while it went down everywhere else. That is the non-sexy thing of prudent planning, having big reserves that you could invest in because you've been saving them up, and by employing this social capital that we are all in this together and we are not going to arbitrarily cut some of our members and some of our people who are part of this group off. The cooperative sector as a whole helped that entire region get out of the crisis much faster and stronger. The cooperative movement kind of acted like a shock absorber for the entire economy. That's a benefit that accrues to everybody, not just the people who are a member of those co-ops.
Wow, that's an amazing story. I mean, if you compare that to here, right? And some of the things that happened in 2008 and also during COVID. I mean, that was a question I had for you. It's just how co-ops are doing through COVID.
This pandemic is terrible. It's obviously a real grind. I mean, within weeks of the lockdown announced, I had one of our co-op members called me to try and help find a buyer for their assets because they were wrapping, they're closing their doors. Some have actually done fine. It's like nothing's really happened, and most are struggling somewhere in between. You know, it's instructive that we see similar kind of behavior to what they experienced in Italy here. I mean, if you think of Vancity being this large financial institution with a lot of resources available to us, that money belongs to our members, whether they're co-op or not. And we were able to invest a lot of our reserves into our members. We provided all kinds of supports. I mean, we provided grant supports in some cases. We provided flexibility in terms of loans and those kinds of things in others. And that practice of mutuality is what is helping a lot of these organizations keep the doors open and not create those kinds of social problems that we want to avoid in our communities.
If you could just talk about different kinds of co-ops you've worked with, just to give listeners a sense of what are different types of co-ops? We've mentioned housing, for example, but what are some other kinds?
Yeah, there's lots of ways of kind of classifying co-ops. And part of that stems from the Cooperative Associations Act, which is the act that governs cooperatives in British Columbia, which is extremely flexible. To form a co-op, you need at least three people or three organizations. Both are allowed. So you can have a co-op of people like you and me, or you could have a co-op of legal entities like individual businesses. You can have co-ops that we would say for profit, although that's a capitalist term, surplus oriented co-ops, or co-ops that are not for profit that have the same kind of asset lock as a not for profit society. The most common way of classifying a co-op is by who's the member. Is it the person using the service? That's a consumer co-op. Credit unions are in that space. Your food co-ops are generally in that kind of space. There was a big flurry of food co-ops in the 60s and 70s, part of the counterculture, but I mean, the history of it goes back quite far. Those are not gone. I work with a group in Squamish. The residents of Squamish are having a really hard time getting access to affordable organic fruits and vegetables in their community. They formed a co-op in order to be able to bulk buy that and then bring it into town and then get it distributed. So that's the basic kind of cooperative stuff that continues to happen. Some really interesting kind of opportunities there. I mean, they're building connections to food suppliers and supply chains and local producers. And it's a really interesting kind of thing that we'll probably need to do, think about more and more as the time goes on. So there's the consumer co-ops. There are what I classify as producer co-ops, that is, individuals or organizations that operate more or less independently, but they share some kind of common infrastructure in order to be able to make their businesses more efficient and effective. That's a space that I'm seeing a lot of, like people that would have been gig workers or people who would have been independent consultants deciding that for their quality of life, they would rather band together with others and have some kind of redundancy in terms of the way they work, but not have to answer to anybody. I'm working with a few co-ops that are just incorporating along those kinds of lines. There's a strong kind of individualistic kind of component to them, but they're smart individualists. They recognize that their success is more likely if they work together in order to be able to compete in the market. It's the best of all possible worlds. On a similar front, there was a group of craft breweries here in East Vancouver, a kind of staggering distance from where I live. And they are nominally competitors with each other, but they formed a cooperative in order to market themselves as a group.
Oh, wow. I think I'm in staggering distance to those as well.
Yeah. So the Yeast Van Brewery District Cooperative is a thing. And, you know, the functionality, again, is pretty basic. They co-brew some beer and they market, you know, they have these events where they have, you know, the food trucks and the, you know, the beer crawls and people can come around and do these kinds of things. Now, these are, again, they're competitors, but they've created a structure by which they all benefit from working together. And, you know, the future of that could be also the joint acquisition of inputs, joint administrative services or bookkeeping or any of those kinds of things are possibilities within that kind of structure. So again, that's a different community. That's a different kind of need. And so it manifests itself in this kind of way. The other major category is the worker cooperative, which is where the people who work at the organization own the means of production. They are the people who work there are the owners who make the decisions in terms of how their businesses are run. There are some excellent examples of that here in the Lower Mainland. I think in particular groups like the Woodshop Workers Cooperative, which is takes waste wood that's destined sort of for the landfill and turns it into fine furnishings.
I didn't know about that one.
That's what I'm talking to you from is a product of theirs. And they produce really beautiful work and they're paying themselves decent wages and they are doing an environmental service. They're reducing the waste that we're producing. All co-ops do good things for their members. It's probably the gold standard, though, right? I mean, it takes a lot of sweat equity. It takes a lot of effort to create such an organization and to keep it moving, right? It's not, if you're a member of a workers' cooperative, it's not a simple thing to go home at the end of the day and not think about the thing that you have, because you are an owner and you need to shepherd that accordingly. But yet they make it work.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So if somebody wants to start up a co-op, what's your advice to them?
Excellent question. I would start by calling the British Columbia Cooperative Association. They have a guide called the Cultivating Co-ops Guide, which is an excellent resource for moving forward. And if people are starting to move forward, we can direct them to the resources that are available, depending on their own kind of aspirations and timelines and capacities. Every co-op is a little bit different. And so we try to direct them to the next phase and try to build out a bit of a map. It could be our boot camp, which is a great way for people to get their feet wet in terms of all these various nuances of what makes for a co-op. Or it could be that they've got an excellent community of interest with all those kinds of skills represented at the table and they're just ready to go. And maybe what they need is just somebody to help them kind of move through the incorporation process. We can identify a co-op developer, like a co-op business developer, who would be able to work with them and run alongside. Or if they're a fully independent type and they know what to do, we hand them the guide and, you know, and send them on their way and encourage them to become a member of the BC Co-op Association to do their banking at a credit union.
Right. At what point should somebody contact the BC Cooperative Association, or I imagine other co-op associations if they're in a different province?
If you're just looking for some resources, I mean, you know, call them whenever you're ready and get access to the guide or something like that. But if you think that you're ready, when do you think you're ready to move forward and actually start like working on that co-op? I would say once you've identified that community, and that community is large enough to include people who are ready to roll up their sleeves and start doing some work. If you've got three people that are willing to work hard on this kind of thing, then you're ready to go. We get inquiries from the one person who's going to, you know, create a co-op, and that's just not possible. I think once you've identified that community of interest and that community shares your vision and your objectives, that's the time, I think, to start moving on that.
All right. Well, that was great. Anything else that I'm missing?
I think you've hit the nail on the head with your questions.
Well, Elvie, thank you so much for joining us today and for all the wonderful information and examples from your extensive experience. So thanks to that trip back in 2004.
Yeah.
You've been able to answer all my questions and contribute to so many co-ops. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to be here with you and to talk to you about this subject.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find links to the materials discussed as well as more information about this podcast series at michellestack.com. I welcome your suggestions for future guests and themes. Feel free to contact me at michelle.stack@ubc.ca or on Twitter @michellestack. Have a great day.